This interview is taking place with Dewey Tippett. It's taking place at his home at 145 Copper Street in Ishpeming. And the interviewer, I'm the interviewer, and my name is Mary Tippett Andes, and Mr. Tippett is my father. Let's start with state your full name and date and place of birth.
Well, my name is Dewey Tippett, and I was born January 24th, 1921, in North Lake location.
And what is your middle name?
Bengry, after my mother's name, family name.
And were you born at home or at a hospital?
I was born at home.
And can you give me the names and birth dates of your parents and your parents' occupation?
My father was born December the 7th in Wisconsin, I believe. And he was born on December the 7th in 1894. And my mother's name was Mary and Edith Banger. She was born on May the 7th in born at home in West Ishpeming in 1895. She was born and died in the same house.
And your father's name?
My father's name was Walter Tippett. I don't believe he had a middle name.
And what were your parents' occupations?
Well, my mother was a housewife, and my dad was, during his short life, had quite a number of jobs. He was worked for the State Highway Department, and he was guard at the Marquette Branch Prison, and he was a police officer, a night captain in the police force in Marquette. And he worked in mines at various times. And his last place he worked is when he lost his life working in the mines.
And which mine was that, and what was the date?
He was killed in a Barnesecker disaster on his first day of work there. That was on November the 3rd in 1926.
Now, can you tell me where you grew up and give me a little chronology of your school, where you went to school, did you graduate from high school, and what did you do after high school?
Well, I was born in North Lake location, and we lived there for a very short time after I was born, and we moved into West Ishpeming location for briefly, and then we moved to Marquette, where my dad was employed at the prison and on the police force in Marquette. And then in the spring of 1926, we moved back to Ishpeming, West Ishpeming, and lived at with my grandfather. My mother came up to Maine to take care of my grandmother, who was ill, and she passed away during the summer of 1926, so my mother stayed on to look after keep house for my grandfather. And so my dad quit his job at the prison in Marquette because it was too hard to travel back and forth in the winter months, and took a job in the mine, and consequently lost his life there. And so we stayed on living with my grandfather until the time I left home. And I went to school in West Ishpeming through the 8th grade, and then attended Ishpeming High School and graduated there.
In what year?
I think 1934. And attended Ishpeming High School and graduated from Ishpeming High School in 1939. And at that time there was, we were still affected by the Great Depression. Jobs were still quite scarce. So after I tramped back and forth for a year trying to get a job in the mine, that there were still regular employees who were laid off, and the mines weren't working very much at that time. So I enlisted in the Navy for 6 years, and that was in June of 1946 or 1940, and for 6 years until June of 1946.
Can you recount for me what you remember? And I guess another piece of information I'd like to fill in is, did your mother ever remarry? If so, to whom, and what did he do? And then also, what do you remember about things that you saw with the local mines in Ishpeming during the time that you were growing up, and the things they might have done to help their employees out?
Well, my mother remarried to Russell Hill, who also worked in a mine. That he was a shift boss at what they call a Section 16 mine, and he was working for the Oliver Iron Mining Company at that time. And I don't remember exactly what year it was that they were married. I imagine it was, I think it was probably around maybe 1930 or 31, to my recollection. And he worked at the Section 16, and he went over to what was the Holmes mine, and then he had a job. He quit there, and he had a job sinking a shaft at the Greenwood mine, and he worked there for a short time, and then he had a job at the Lloyd mine in North Lake, and that's where he retired from the Lloyd mine. I don't remember what year he retired, but I'd have to do some checking, remember, to find out, recall this one at that time.
Now, during the time that you were growing up, were there times when the production was low and there was a need for the mine to make some special considerations to help the employees out?
Well, to my recollection, maybe. Cleveland Cliffs Iron Company was, I think most of the mines were working down to a 2 day a week schedule. The mine actually worked perhaps 4 days a week, but they split it up so that the employees could get at least two days a week of work, and as much as possible. I don't remember for how long that went, because I was quite young at that time, and I don't recall too much about what the working schedule was. But I know that in the summertime that they recall that the mining companies gave out garden plots on company land, or they did the plowing and so forth for the to give out prepare garden plots so that the employees could, if they wish, could have a plant a garden and raise potatoes and vegetables so to help them through the winter months. And they also, at that time, wood was the main fuel that people used, so they, during their time off, they'd cut wood and prepare their winter fuel in, and mining company often gave wood lots off from company land there so that they could go in and cut the winter supply of wood. And people used to get together and help each other to harvest the wood, and when they get it home, they'd get together with work bees together to help their neighbors to get the wood sawed, and then after the wood was sawed up into stove lengths and everything, and then it was up to the individuals to split and pile their own wood and store it away there for the winter. But the people helped each other a whole lot, and back then, to as good neighbors and family members, to help each other because it was pretty much a matter of survival. And would be nice to see a lot of that same attitude that would prevail today, but you don't see so much of it anymore. It seems to be everybody for themselves these days.
Tell me what you remember about the seeing the stockpiles of ore staked off during that period.
Well, as I recall it, especially at the traveling back and forth to town, back in those days, you walked, you didn't ride because there wasn't very many cars that were running, especially in the winter time. Walking to town, you had to travel, walk right by the Cliff Shaft mine, and with the stockpile ground was right out to the road, and right back into some of the houses there along and going into town. And I remember seeing stakes up on the along the stockpiles in there, and I was told that there were tags on the stakes that you could see. I couldn't read them from the road from where you could see them, but I was told that those stakes indicated that that there was a lien on a certain amount of tonnage in the stockpiles, and that those stakes indicated that the banks or what the companies who held a lien on a certain amount of ore. That's what the company used to try to keep the miners working.
Anything else about that period of time that you recall that you'd like to put on tape?
Well, right at the moment, I don't know. There probably are other things, but not some of the things that come to mind. There's nothing that I can think of right now. There are probably other things that will come up from time to time that I could recall. That if I do in my growing up years, there's a lot of these things that you start reminiscing about, but it takes a little while to recall them sometimes.
Let's go back then and pick up where we left off with getting out of the service. And the service is a whole other story. There's one incident I might ask you to talk about later on. But you were discharged from the Navy when, and then what did you do after that?
Well, I was discharged from the Navy on the 8th of June in 1946. And at that time, the people that were discharged from service were guaranteed a benefit of $20 a week for 52 weeks, which we call the 5220 Club. And of course, that didn't really go very far anyway, but it was nice to have that to fall back on until you get a job. So then, in August of 46, I got a job working for New Ani Mining Company, or Cleveland Cliffs there, but at the Mazaray Mine. It was a fairly new mine at that time. It was just really beginning to grow, so I had a job there. I had it before I, during the summer months of my high school years, I worked. The summer being 1938, I had a job working for a contractor building a new school in the North Lake location up there, and I worked on the foundation part there during the summer months, and we worked for 35 cents an hour mixing and pouring concrete and hand shoveling gravel. And during the hot days, you didn't stop to take a drink of water too often because somebody else is ready to take your job if you slow down. And we were very, very well satisfied to work for 35 cents an hour.
Now, one thing we didn't mention was that you were a veteran of World War II, and the time that you were discharged from the service was when the war was over. When you started working at the Mazaray, what was your job, and do you remember what your hourly rate of pay was?
Well, I started to work at the Mazaray, and my first job was cleaning track. That's what most cases had new employees, there was laborers. I was a laborer, but they started off with a pick and shovel. Cleaning track. The track is where Holly's locomotive is just to haul supplies in and out from the shaft in supplies in, and the work trains would come out. So there's a lot of spillage of ore, especially on their loading chutes and everything, and this place had to be cleaned up there to keep the track in good shape. And I think at the time I started, I was still in service when the first big strike here came into being in 1946. I think strike started in March and ended up around in June, if I'm not mistaken. But I was still in the service at the time, so I don't know. I recall very little about the thing that happened with the strike, but that one of the agreements at that time was the wage agreement was where wages were $1 an hour, but with some shift differential involved. There were two for a couple of cents for afternoon shift and a couple more cents for night shift. So basically I started cleaning track and then went from cleaning track to a timber hoister.
Can you describe how long did you clean track, and then what does a timber hoister do?
Well, I only cleaned track for a couple of weeks there because, like I say, it was a new mine, and there was, as the mine expanded, there was new contracts were opening up for contract mining, and that's what most of the guys that were working down there were looking for an opportunity to get into a contract as a contract miner, because they were paid on an incentive basis there. That if you work harder, you can make more money. Because you were paid, usually that time by the miners were paid by the car for producing ore, or if they were driving drifts in there and so on, they were paid by the foot for advancing the heading of a drift. But to get off, you kind of had to work your way up from starting off as a general labor, the track cleaner, and you get timber hoisting with you. In the hematite mines, you had when they drove drifts, you had to support the ground in there because it was soft ore. You had it, and at that time they were using wood timber, and consequently they were hoisting these supplies up to the miners with poles and lagging and wood timber, and that's where the title of timber hoister came in. And you hoist the supplies up in the rays from the supply that we brought in on trucks and dropped off in different places underneath raises up there to be hoisted up to the miners working in areas up above the main level. And after timber hoisting, if you had, you get out to what they call a company account job, would be mainly going scraping from the transfer where the miners would get up above the main level, a few sub-levels up where the ore had to be scraped out to get into the main raises there for ore chutes there to be loaded into cars down on the main level. So there would be scraping when there would be transfer scraping when there would be scraping the ore out. And then as these stokes were developed, you would go in and the miners would do a stoping, and that's where they drill and blast in the long hole. They did have a few bench stokes there where they worked from what they call a bench stope, or a bench. They drill your hole off from a bench and out there around the edge of a big opening where the stope actually was a big void as the ore was removed. And you could see out in it, the bigger it got, the really it was kind of hard to see out. You see nothing but darkness out there. But you scraped the ore out through these mill raises and down on the transfers. And then from job the scraping and out, you get some company account jobs was timbering, putting in repair timber, and there was levels are different working areas that begin to take a lot of weight. They say a safe place to work in is a place that was taking weight because the ground was moving and coming down, there's nothing hanging up, so if you know that the place is taking weight, it's a safer place to work in. And so consequently some of these places would get heavy and the timber would break or the drift would get kind of small, so you'd have to go and open it up and put in new timber and stuff in there, so you'd have timbering jobs. And contract miners would also repair their own contract, but they were placed on the main level where timbermen would do that kind of work. So. And then to get into contract mining is where you were paid by incentives, either by so much per car, you get paid by the car more you produced, or if you're stoking, and if you're drifting, you're paid by the foot, depending on ore would be one price, and the size of the drift would be one thing, and a main level drift in rock would be something else again, and in some places where you had good rock, you could drive what they call a naked drift. There were no supports in there, but the ground was of such a nature that they didn't need support. And then when you got into areas where you had to use supports, well, then you'd get paid a little bit more because you had to use timber, putting up the timber and stuff.
I'd like to back up a little bit and get some of these terms defined. And before we do that, we kind of stopped with what jobs you had with, I'm assuming that all the things that you've described are jobs that you moved through. But if you can kind of go in order and tell me, you were a timber hoister for about how long? You were laborer, you said, for 2 weeks, a timber hoister for about how long? And then what jobs and about how long for each of those during the time that you worked in the mines? Without going into detail on what they are, I'd like to just get that chronology down first and then go back and talk about some of the words that you've already started to use.
I was a general laborer for a few weeks. I don't remember just how long it was, but it was a few weeks. And then on the timber hoisting for probably... few months, but as different opportunities came along, you sometimes you get shifts doing different kinds of work too, so you weren't doing the same thing every day, but I would say like timber hoisting for a few months too, and then scraping for a while, but I don't think that was less than a year, I believe less than a year, and then I had a job as a contract miner because of the, like I say, it was a fairly new mine, and it was expanding as new levels opened up and new work areas, where then they could add on more contracts, and because the mine expanded to get up to its production potential and the production schedule, they had to have more mining contracts in order to develop the areas and to mine the ore after these areas were developed. They were developing contracts, and then those guys that put up the miners that put up the raises and drove the drifts, and then there were some guys of miners that were moved in as production miners as taking the ore out. Some men preferred to stay on development, and some would rather have the scoping took some experience too for with the benches and so on. But the methods of mining changed quite rapidly too from the time that I started down there, because they went from the bench slopes didn't last very long. They went to sub-level caving and long hole drilling and even some of those. Types of mining were modified and changed when they found better systems of doing it. Well, each new system was mainly was a lot of it was involved safety, and it bottom line is cutting costs, cutting production costs. So there are better ways of doing things, safer and cheaper. So
let's go a little bit ahead now. I still want to backtrack and get some of the terms down. But you were a contract miner with all of its various still different little other tasks. For about how long, and then what after that, and for how long?
Well, about 20 developing and driving a dish, you're going to develop an area for stoping where you would put up arrays from the main level. In some places, they have regular arrays that they call arrays miners. Their job exclusively was to put up crib raises, and a crib raise is each compartment with approximately 4 foot square. Sometimes you had a single raise that would go up and for a ladder load and supplies and everything, and then another raise would be, sometimes you have a two compartments, and one side would be for manway and supplies, and the other one would be for the ore passes for dropping the ore down from up ore down to the main level where it would be loaded into cars. And when you put up a raise, then you cut out the little raise, they drive drifts in, and most of the drifts were in ore development were all timbered and I say, when I started mining, they were used wood timber, and then over a period of time, there were various types of steel supports they put in there. The steel was more expensive to the higher cost for steel to begin with, but it reduced a great amount the amount of repair work that was done. So all in all, over a period of time, and the steel was more economical to use because it lasted longer and it was stronger. And there were times that there was a whole lot of repair work that had to be done even with steel, because when one of the old miners used to say it on there, he said, "You can't hold up the state of Michigan with a couple of props." So when you start opening up an underground down there, especially getting in the areas where there's ore, where it takes a lot of weight. And mainly the main level drifts were driven into what they call the footwell in the rock, so that the drifts held up better there, and they were And then you get in, you fall in just along the foot, close to the ore body, and then you go what they call a crosscut that would go into the, from the main line would be branch lines off to go into the ore, so you could get into the ore body and develop the ore.
At what point, you were a supervisor underground for a while. We need to talk about that a little bit. At what point did you become a supervisor, and then what did you do that on all three shifts, and about for how long, and then what jobs did you have in order until you retired, and when was that?
Well, I was mining until I don't remember exactly when I started shift boss, and we were.
We're going to stop and go to the second side of the tape. This is side number two, tape number one of Dewey Tippett, with the interview taking place on April 24th, 1994. We started to talk before I turned the tape over about being a supervisor and about when that happened and what your responsibilities were.
Well, I think it was about 1950 or 51 when I went to offer the job as a shift boss. And at the time we were offered the job as a shift boss, we were opening up, driving the main level drift the rafters for 7th level at Monterey. And one of the things that I always remember about that was not ready to take the job immediately because we had what we know today that we called a big half coming, where we had lots of footage and we were going to make big money, and I would have lost 2 time-and-a-half shifts on a Saturday and a Sunday night. And but anyway, when I was offered a job and I said I would take it, so I went back into my contract, and it wasn't in there very long when the foreman came in and I wanted to know if I was taking the job, and he said, "You come out right now." So I had to start right away. But the job as a supervisor was they had the mining captain, the second captain, and then they had shift foreman, and they were supervisor was referred to as a shift boss. And you worked three shifts, day, afternoon, and night shift. And you had mainly you were given a certain area of the mine that you were responsible for to see that the work was getting done. And you'd have general labor's working under you, and you have the scraper men, or you had miners, and whatever type of mining was going on, well, you had to supervise it. And so you had a quite a variety of things that you were responsible for, seeing that was getting done.
Can you tell me, was each shift boss responsible for one level, or for the whole mine, or for about how big would the number of men on the crew that you were responsible for be, and how big an area of the mine would that encompass?
Well, that varied, because sometimes some of the levels that didn't have too many people working on it, one boss could take care of one level, but there were times when we had as many as four and sometimes five bosses on one level, because if the level covered a big area and you had a lot of mining operations going on one level, you were given a certain territory of that level to take care of, and that was referred to as your run. That was the run used if you make that, and you had to cover your territory twice a shift. And so sometimes the distance between levels and everything was, sometimes you had contracts that would be up, you had to climb up to a couple hundred feet to get up to them, and sometimes it was easier to go in on another level and start to climb down than it would be to keep climbing from the bottom up. So your way of covering your territory had some different variations about how you would depend on what kind of access you had to the part of the mine you were responsible for. So, and then different times you might be given a different assignment. If your condition changed in one part of the mine and there was something that part of it would be some certain area being mined out, well, then you would be given another area to look after. And so as conditions in the mine change, some of your responsibilities would change too. So,
and the size of the number of men that you would have, that you had to that had reporting to you, would vary from how few to how many on a given shift.
Well, when I It varied somewhat, but as a rule, your problems will be dependent on the shift that you're on. It probably vary from somewhere between 20 to 40 or 45 men, sometimes 50 men on a shift. And one of the reasons I recall some of that is because I was after I got out of the Navy, I signed up in the Naval Reserve to protect my rating in the Navy. And then when the Korean War started, I was subject to recall and to active duty again. But my job as a supervisor in a vital industry, iron ore mining, they would send me questionnaire that I had to send in that regarding what my responsibilities were as far as my job is concerned. And so my job as a supervisor have kept me from going back into the Korean War.
All right. You were a supervisor then until, or for about how long, and then what did you do after that and why?
Well, I was a supervisor at Mather Ray until I think 1959. I think I was transferred to the Mather B. as a shift boss, and then when Mather Ray shut down a year later. I stayed on as a supervisor over there, but there were some changes made when some of the bosses came over from Mather A to B shaft, and then some of the other mines shut down. There were bosses coming in, and I ended up as a dispatcher at Mather B, and I think I held that job for 15 years, I guess. But the dispatcher job was to control the haulage more throughout the mine. And by radio, you would direct each locomotive was traveled by were communicated with a radio by radio. And I think there was a time when we were responsible for as many as about 15 or 17 motors traveling on various levels. Sometimes we had seven or eight trains on one level and all traveling on the same track from shaft inside. So you had a direct traffic so that prevent collisions from trains that were going in empty for more ore and those that wanted to come waiting to come out shaft to bring out other trains out shaft. Beside the train, the supplies had to go in and out. And there were times when we had some accidents too, because mistakes were made. And the motor operators, the motormen as they were called, motor operators were not allowed to move their motor or their train without permission from the dispatcher. And when they got their train loaded, they would call into the dispatcher, say they were loaded, and the dispatcher would direct their movement from there in the shaft. Sometimes trains would go off the track and traffic would be tied up, and there were times when there was a misunderstanding of the instructions and there would be a collision and some resulted in serious accidents. And I never had any myself that I could say that was were involved any bad personal physical injuries to people there, but sometimes the equipment was banged up a little bit there, but the main concern was not so that people wouldn't get hurt, so. But there were, they say there were a few accidents involving people too who were seriously injured. But it was kind of a nerve-wracking job because you know that you're responsible for the safety of so many people there that making a mistake that I was. It was always in the back of your mind, so that I stayed there as a dispatcher at the Mallard until Mallard V closed in 1979, and on our shift there was the day shift on the last day of mine work. We hoisted the last skips of ore from the Mallard V mine on our crew. And then from there I was transferred to the Empire Mine. And I went to the Empire Mine as a supervisor, and I was a primary crusher and conveyor foreman. And then I held that job until I retired in April of 1983.
All right, lots of terms, lots of things to talk about. I think what I'd like to do is fill in some of the information about your job as a dispatcher first, and then work backward a little bit. I'm particularly interested in what you said about hoisting the last of the ore out of the Mather B. Can you describe a little bit about what that day was like, and was there any special commemoration done of the last hoist out of the mine? And what do you remember the date?
Well, I think it was July 30th or 31st of 1979, I think was the last day, and then it was, I was on vacation, and then it was the middle of August when I started at the Empire. And I'm pretty sure it was day shift on July 30th or 31st of 1979. And I guess they were there just to take some, I don't remember all of the detail, but they were there, there was some official there to take pictures of the last skip of ore that came up, and I think that they had some TV people there and talking to some of the miners that as they came up from underground on the last shift there, is what their sentiments were about the mine, the last closing of the last underground iron ore mine. So it was a kind of a nostalgic thing, you know, that was the last of the underground mine, but when we were at the Empire Mine, and there was fellows that I worked with over there that didn't like the open pit mines very much. And they said if they start pumping water at the Mather B, they said they'd be the first one to sign up to go back and underground. Because they people liked the underground miners enjoyed working underground. It was a good place to work.
Why?
Well, it was a time it could be a dirty job, and there was wet places and dry places, but it seemed that the people that worked underground had a little different attitude about their job, because there was people would help each other, and there was an order to contract miners even if it was putting up a set of timber was consisted of a two legs, and what they call the cap, put up two legs and they put the cap on, but some of these caps was pretty heavy. So you go in the neighboring contract, and we need a hand to lift cap. Sure, so over the company, you'd help each other out that way. And when the thing down there, we'd go down to work and underground, it was, every day was the same. It was, you're around, you're dressed the same. The stuff, you could be very cold outside when you go to work. You go underground, we're nice and warm. In summertime, you'd be up 90 degrees, it's hot. You go underground, and nice and cool.
About what was the temperature underground?
Oh, I don't remember. I don't know if there was any actual count. Well, some places was different because there were some places that did get hot down there. But it would depend on how well the ventilation was. We had big fans that would force air down, and they had where it would come down through, air would come down through, I believe it was matter A and out through matter B there, but it was where the mines were connected up there, and that was mainly for ventilation, and it was also, maybe after matter A shut down, it was a second out, it was an escape route for any problem that might have showed up, happened over on the B shaft side, you had an escape route. But sometimes by working on the main level would be the coldest because that's where the main flow of air would be. But you had the flow of air through the mine was controlled by what they call air doors. You could direct the air, the flow of air through different portions of the mine to ventilate it by the use of doors and fans. But the temperature varied throughout the mine, but it was, as a rule, it was, you didn't have to wear any special clothes for different places you worked in. If you were not going down to work, then you wore an overall jacket or some kind of a jacket. When you get into the working place, you take it off, and you didn't have very much, you were very comfortable to work.
All right, clothing is another topic I want to get back to. I guess I'd like to focus a little bit for now on your job as a dispatcher. What was the area called in which you worked, and where was it located?
Well, they called it a dispatcher shack. And you had, well, when they first began using a dispatcher to direct all the traffic, they had a dispatcher on each level, and the dispatcher would control the trains on just on his level. And then I believe they put up maps, what they call a map board, that was a diagram of the levels and the crosscuts in there with all the chute numbers and everything in there, and then you would crosscuts are numbered and chutes would be numbered, and you would direct the traffic to go in and out from more than one level, and then finally it was moved to a job on surface and control for surface, and then you took care of the whole mine. And You answered phone calls for on the afternoon and the night shift. The people would call in for not being able to come to work or giving an excuse for not coming to work, and any emergencies there. Well, you would handle them from there, and then you also controlled the time we held fire drills or an emergency drill, not necessarily just for a fire, but it'd be an emergency drill, and you would wait until all the men got into their working place, and then you would pass the word by radio that you were having a emergency evacuation drill, and they tell these people where to come down from their working places and where they had to go to report to their immediate supervisor so everybody could be accounted for. And these drills were carried on periodically, and the men were never notified ahead of time that there was going to be a drill, but it would see how long it would take for these men to reach a safe haven or a place where they could be accounted for and be given further instruction, whether they had to leave the mine or where to go in a different part of the mine that would be in a safe area for them to be in. So if this happened to be for a fire or something like that, well, you know how to get it, how to get them out and where to go. And mainly was just a rehearsal as a safety factor to find out how long they were going to take, and just so that people would be familiar with what to do if there was an emergency. So.
And how long would it take once the word was given that there was a drill, an emergency drill, until the time that everybody was accounted for?
Well, it varied somewhat from some of the men that weren't too happy about it because they had probably have to climb down 150 feet away or something like that, or from be up working up in a high place, and they'd have to come back down again. So it probably would take 7 or 8 minutes to get them down to the point there before you could. And then each station had to account for these people, and then it would be. You had to, whenever these drills were being held, there would be supervisors, either in most cases, the mine superintendent would be present to see how these things were being coordinated. And then after it was, everybody was accounted for, and then they would say, okay, send the men back to work. So then you tell them, okay, the drill is over, and they would go back into the work areas again. So it was just a matter of a few minutes in it. The men would be to the places that they have, that different areas of the mine, they had different areas to report to their immediate supervisor. So maybe it would be if you had two bossy shacks on a level, whatever boss they were accountable to, they would have to go to these different shift bossy shacks and report in there, and guys that were out mainly in the area of the shaft where the skip tenders and cave rider would be down there, some people working around the shaft they would call in that over in an intercom system and let you know that they were at their station there, so then they'd be all accounted for. So
how was the word passed underground? Did the guys in the drifts have radios, or was there somebody sent up the 150-foot ladder, or could they just yell, or how would they get the word to the people in the drifts?
Well, there would be, of course, all the locomotives had radios, and then they had intercom systems there, placed throughout the mine. Anybody that happened to be that it wasn't within hearing distance of an intercom, most working areas would have one. But if there was guys that would be a little bit away from the intercom, or anybody else that was in the working area, they would have to account for each other, pass the word on, or we got an evacuation drill. But they were very good about cooperating and passing word on to each other, accounting for each other, in other words, to make sure that they got down to report into where they were supposed to go. But they had those radios and intercom system and such as a PA system, and word of mouth.
Can you describe a typical interaction between you and a motorman when you were the dispatcher? What exactly was said? What would you say? What would the person below say?
Well, if you had at the beginning of the shift, when you started off the shift, all the motors on each level, the dirt trains, and they would bring their cars out shaft, and they had a cage flat side, or what you call a cage flat, was the side where the supplies came down on, and the supply motor would pick up his. There was a double track there on the flat, so that mainly for a place to hold supplies that they were taken off the cage. You come down on the cage, and they would be left on the flat, And there were some areas inside that there would be drifts that were not actually any mining operation going on, and there would be, the supplies would be stored in there. And then over on the, what they call the skip road side or the dump side would be the haulage trains would be over on the other side. And when these, each locomotive was numbered, and they had so many cars that they would, and usually the same cars would be hooked to the train. Except when they came out to the dump, and they'd leave off a train on one side, and then that would be hauled through the dump automatically, and they would just hook them up to the, they call them hook them up to the dump, and then a hydraulic system would pull the cars through the dump and dump them into the skips. And the skip turner would control the movement of the cars that they were dumping. Well, then they get onto the empty car side. As they passed over the dump, they get over on the empty car side, and there was a couple of tracks over there, and then they'd motorman would go in and pick up whatever it was, 7 or 8 cars or whatever is 8-9 car train that they would have. Well, somewhere mainly I think it was pretty much a 10 car train. But sometimes the length of the train would vary depending on what cars were available too. And so when he had his train ready, the motorman would report into the dispatcher, and he would call in his by his motor number as a so say like 12th level. Well, he'd have maybe a 1201 might be a supply motor, maybe you got 1208, 1209, 1212, whatever, each motor was numbered, but the level number preceded his locomotive number. So you know that on the 12th level, motor number 8 is ready to go inside. Okay, you tell him, okay, you can go into a certain cross cut. So you're going to probably go into if you had ore that the scraperman or places that you knew pretty much ahead of time at the beginning of the shift, you knew where we were going to be, where ore was going to be hauled from. You had maybe 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 cross cuts that this mine ever worked, and that's where the ore was coming from. So you say, well, I'm going to went to 1208 cross cut. So that's a 12th level number 8 cross cut on 12th level. So sometimes it'd be 1208 more to go into 1208 cross cut. So, each locomotive was numbered, and you gave them the instructions where to go from there. But sometimes if they go in there, there wouldn't be enough to load his train, well, then you'd send them to another cross cut. But in the meantime, they say 6 or 8 ore trains hauling down there, you have to coordinate them so that they go in, so many can go in. Sometimes you load in 2 or 3 trains in one crosscut. You'd have a different loading station in there, so they would go in there and load that way. And then sometimes you could have them follow out as many as 2 or 3 trains. You could handle 2 in a dump, down in a dump area this time, and they call a tail room. They go down into the dump, another one go down in the tail room. And then when the first train got through the dump, and he'd back out and come around, go onto the empty car side. He'd have to come back up on the main line and then go on the empty car side. Well, you'd have another one. There's always a dam just before you get to where the trains are going onto the cage flat or under the dump down there at the deep. There's a dam there and the purpose of the dam is in case you have a water problem, mine starts to flood, you put these timbers in the dam and you could block off the level. So that was a place where you could, where everybody knew, go on as far as the dam, he would and hold there and wait for further instructions from there. So when the other motors got into the empty car side, and the dump was cleared, and you could send, maybe you could have two trains waiting at the dam. But that's just one of the reasons for the dispatcher was, so before the time of dispatchers, you use a shaft light. When the motor went out the shaft, whether it be a supply motor went the shaft to go out to pick up some trucks of timber or whatever, supplies, he turned on a shaft light. It would be a red light, and then any train coming down to that switch there would know that there was a motorized shaft, and he had to wait until that one came in. So in the meantime, near the motor below the train sitting waiting there. Maybe there's a, maybe the skips are idle empty out there. But this way with a controlling it with a dispatcher, you could direct traffic out there and you'll keep a pretty steady flow of ore coming out there. You speed it up the operation a lot.